There's only two types of guys out there. Ones that can handle me and the ones that are scared. Well, baby, I hope that you can prepare.
Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we created a circus out of them.
That's right, an entire circus out of books and imagination.
That's why we love books so much, because they're populated by your imagination.
That's right.
And this week's entry definitely relies on your imagination.
Yes, my argument was that we could answer any of our usual questions in our outline with your imagination for this book.
So we're going to see how that goes.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's going to be like a 10-minute conversation. We are talking about The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern this week.
Yes, we are. A fairly recent publication. Last year, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
One of those.
One of them. 2011.
Yeah, okay. So, published in 2011, it's been making the rounds, suggested to us by a handful of people on and offline.
Mm-hmm.
And so, spoiler alert is in effect, which I don't know if it should have been for any of our last several books, but
we ignored it a couple times.
Been probably several episodes since we bothered to bring it up.
But this one, I mean, this one's definitely a spoiler alert since it just came out, and there are actually a couple of revelations that, if some people got spoiled, would, yes, be terribly displeased, which is why Ben and I are both a little annoyed with the dust jacket summary.
Yeah, so if you're a person who gets all butthurt by a spoiler, now is the time to drop until you read the book. You know, before you read The Dust Jacket and learn that when Celia discovers that Marco is her adversary, etc., etc. You don't learn that to, like, the 300th page, really.
Yeah.
Or at least the characters don't.
And also,
there's another big bomb, too.
Yeah. let me find my... Where are you? Oh, I thought they actually said straight up in the summary that one of them had to die. But I guess it only kind of suggests that.
All right. But also, totally, one of them has to die, which you don't learn until, like, the 350th page of the book.
You don't find out until the end. Mm-hmm. And if you read the summary, it gives way too much away.
I agree.
So don't do that.
Yeah. And so one of the interesting things about this book is that it was originally written for NaNo, as we affectionately refer to, National Novel Writing Month.
I think I read somewhere that the author was writing the book and she was bored with the characters and she just said, what would happen if I put them all in a circus? And so obviously her first draft was much different than her final draft because the current version of the book completely centers around the circus.
Yeah, if you removed the circus, this would be a 3-page book.
So I wonder what it was like. She's probably a smart decision on her part.
In fact, I would like to give my synopsis of the book if one were to remove the circus from it.
Okay.
Marco and Celia love each other and we have no idea why. Which, by the way, is pretty close to my synopsis for the book with the circus.
Except that there's the circus.
Except that there is the circus.
Yeah, what is our plot synopsis? Well,
we have two entries this week.
Yeah. There was mine, which is a lot of people do a lot of stuff.
And mine, which was your imagination. Prepare for a lot of that.
Yeah. So the genre is kind of an historical fiction, fantasy, magic setting. It's turn of the century, 20th century, so it's late 1800s, early 1900s, and set all around Europe. London's kind of the center of it, but they go everywhere, and they go over a little bit to America, too.
Yeah, and to go really even deeper into the setting for this, the circus itself, which we'll talk a lot more about in a couple minutes here. Mm-hmm. But the setting is almost the reason to read this book, I think. I would argue that, at least.
Yeah, so just to point out a couple interesting tidbits about the Night Circus. Aptly named because it starts when the sun sets and closes when the sun rises. Different from most, I'm going to say all circuses.
Yes, I've
actually
never heard of a circus that does that.
And it is populated by the things that seem magical, but people think of can't actually be magic, but are actually magic.
Right. That's part of the fascination of this circus, is that it is highly unusual and does things that people don't see, and that, I mean, basically what you just said, things that you would usually assume are illusions, in this case, are actually just straight up magic.
Straight up. We'll talk more about that later on.
So the story is told third person through various people and non-chronologically.
Yeah,
we haven't done a whole lot of books that are told out of sequence yet.
And we didn't talk about it a whole bunch while we were outlining the non-chronological format of the book. There are reasons to do it. You know, if you have a revelation you want to happen at the end that would normally happen somewhere else if you told it chronologically, or tidbits that you want to come out at certain times but would have to come out earlier than you wanted to if you were to chronologically. Those are good reasons to have it jump around in space and time.
Right.
I think the non-chronological feel of this book is partially to add to the magic and whimsy of the circus.
I think so, because I'm not convinced that the story proper needs to be told that way.
Yeah, and at the end, all of the threads converge, and it is just chronological.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, I'm going to go ahead and say that usually non-chronological storytelling isn't a problem for me, and with this book I found it just a little bit confusing, and I think that's because it wasn't entirely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I kept having to flip back to the front of the chapter I just read and gone, when was this one again?
This one, 3 years, like, do they know who each other are yet? Are they in love? Has Bailey seen Poppy? Like,
significant? I don't know.
Yeah, so we'll maybe touch on that a little more later, but
yeah.
Do we have a protagonist?
Your imagination!
Lol.
Lol. I don't think we do. I mean, if you have to choose...
I think Celia and Marco kind of act as a co-protagonist. Because the entire story is really focused around them and their challenge.
I mean, ultimately the plot is centered around their thread, but I just don't think that they're the focus of this book.
Well, one on their own can't be, for
right,
sure.
Right.
Because one of the parts about the challenge is that the two players in the challenge become so inextricably intertwined that they basically can't exist. You know, you can't talk about one without talking about the other one.
Right, because the challenge requires both of them.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to say, is the setting almost the main character? Like, is that possible? You hear people say that about certain stories sometimes, almost always about a movie shot in New York, which, by the way, F you, I don't care.
Ben is disapproving. Disapproving, Ben is disapproving.
I think it's a stupid thing to say. But,
but like, the setting, I mean, the argument I made is setting can be kind of a character, like when we talked about Lord of the Rings, the New Zealand landscape in that movie is fairly crucial to the movie.
Now, certainly... Yeah, I mean, absolutely essential to the visual component of it. I mean, I kind of lean towards, by definition, the setting can't be a character because it's the setting. But it can certainly be, I think when people say that, what they're really saying is it's a really significant aspect of the storytelling.
Well, one of the interesting things about this setting that makes it more like a character is because it's being manipulated so directly by the characters
right.
that it almost has a living, changing quality of its own. So, you know, the Night Circus to a degree, or the circus itself to a degree, is Marco and Celia.
Right, I mean,
because they put so much of their own magic and will into it.
And if you want to get some of their characterization out of the book, you almost have to do it through the things they've created within the circus.
Uh-huh.
So in that way, it kind of fits.
I think more so than just, like, interesting circus setting.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Which, by the way, is something that I might be into if it was just interesting circus setting, because you know how I am with universes and such.
Mm-hmm.
Though, I did kind of want to point out there's a little bit of difference to me between an interesting setting and an interesting universe, because, like, the rules... I mean, there is the magic... I guess that means the rules were pretty significantly different from our universe as we understand it.
Oh.
Ooh. Mm. Hmm. But there wasn't like a whole history and background thing that I was really curious to know about. Everything was just for the circus, which is like a little oasis of magic in the middle of a whole big world that mostly doesn't believe in it.
Uh-huh. Or really have it.
Or really have it, that they know of, at least.
Uh-huh.
So, I guess, the book opens.
Yeah, Celia, her mother had a fling with Prospero the magician at just a local normal circus, you would assume. depressed, kills herself. Drops or sends Celia off to go be with her father, and he's impressed enough by the magic she can already do that he decides it's time to make another challenge.
Yeah, the challenges that he's been having with his old teacher, I guess it turns out at the very
end. Old teacher.
Alexander A.H. for most of the book.
He wears a gray suit.
The man in the gray suit. For maybe even more of the book.
I put white on the outline.
Did you?
What's wrong with me? Ugh. So offended by myself. But all we know is what Celia knows about the challenge, which is just she's in a challenge. She is going to have a competitor. She won't necessarily know who they are. And she will know the setting, because she does figure out it's the circus since her dad sends her to go be at the circus. And then she has to create magic. And that's pretty much all she knows.
Yep. They don't know. Pretty much the only rule that is set in stone is you're not to interfere directly with the other competitor.
Uh-huh.
So, in other words, you can't just go stab them to death and declare yourself the winner.
Right, or like if Marco creates a tent, you can't like burn his tent down.
Right.
They know that.
You just make a competing tent.
And I wonder if that's part of the reason you felt like there was a lag / lack of plot, is because the challenge is so unclearly defined and they're stuck just kind of doing the magic without knowing why for such a long time, that it felt a little directionless.
That could be part of it, and, I mean, that might be... I will also acknowledge the possibility that that could be intentional,
because
it puts the reader in the same place as the characters,
because
they are equally frustrated with not knowing what the terms of the contest are.
Uh-huh.
It comes up again and again, especially with Celia.
Yeah.
She's like, damn it, just tell me what to do. Well, I can't tell you what to do. That's not how this contest works. Your contest is stupid, Dad, and so are you.
Yeah.
I hate you.
Get out of here.
Get out of here.
Creepo ghost stalker.
Yeah, ghostly weirdo. who are some of these people we're talking about?
Yeah. Cecilia's father, Prospero the magician.
Musician.
He plays a saxophone.
Musician.
He was kind of the one who perfected this do real magic for a crowd, but they will believe it's not real. And A.H., his teacher slash competitor slash enemy, whatever you want to call it.
Frenemy,
yeah. he's very opposite style of magic, so he thinks Prospero is way too flashy. You shouldn't go out and do this in front of a bunch of people. You know, he does magic by studying books and writing down complicated spells, whereas, like, Prospero's style is just kind of...
direct physical manipulation.
Yeah. So, you know, later in the book, when Celia and Marco are talking about it, Celia created all her tents and at all times is using her will to keep them going, whereas Marco writes these kind of binding spells so he doesn't really have to do anything anymore.
He kind of sets it in motion and lets go of it.
Right. So she's really jealous of him because... she doesn't know how to do that, but then he's impressed that she's constantly making magic happen.
She seems to have a little more in the way of raw power.
Yeah.
But she has to work a lot harder to keep all her stuff going.
So you have the two schools of magic.
Yes. And actually, there's a comment in there somewhere, like the last 7 or 8 competitions have not gone Prospero's way, so...
Uh-huh.
Maybe his new school is not as conducive to winning challenges.
Yeah.
Even if it is technically stronger magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we don't really know a whole bunch about Alexander.
No.
He's very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
He just shows up in his gray suit and is kind of there.
And as far as we can tell, hundreds of years old...
Yeah, both of them are definitely real old, because the last contest ended 80-plus years ago.
And lasted
37 years.
Yeah.
and
that was...
Yeah, there have been a minimum of 7 of these things, because Prospero's on a 7-challenge losing streak, but we have no idea how many were happening before that.
Yeah.
Maybe the reference to Merlin goes all the way back to these guys' childhood.
Yeah.
We could have been around a long, long, long time. And so their students are the competitors, Celia and Marco, who...
Mm-hmm.
We just don't know a ton about them either, honestly. I mean, Marco is tall, and he's good-looking, and he is kind of... I mean, he's bookish...
Yeah, and one of his things at the beginning is he was shut away for so much of his childhood, and exactly what he could do or where he was go was so prescribed by his teacher that when he does get out on his own, he, you know, immediately seeks out a girlfriend,
yeah.
Isabel, because he just wants to have a relationship that's his, although that doesn't end up great.
Yeah.
And... he loves Celia.
And Celia is attractive and does lots of magic.
And had a pretty abusive childhood.
Yeah, her dad was a bit sadistic in his teaching methods, like cutting open her fingertips and waiting for her to heal them and then cutting them open again so she'd get faster at it.
Or the incident with the bird that died.
Yeah. Just kills the bird in front of her because she couldn't heal it properly.
Yeah, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah. But she doesn't really act like she's been abused.
No.
That being said.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that struck me is, like, it's talking about him doing magic on stage and her, like, curled up in a ball backstage, like, sobbing.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy shit, she's gonna be fucked up. But she was actually...
pretty... warm, like, open person as
yeah.
an adult.
Yeah.
Didn't have any of the defense mechanisms you would expect her to have.
Yeah, and even lets her dad hang around much longer than...
yeah.
I think I would have.
She kind of tries to block him out when he's all ghostly and stuff.
Yeah.
For privacy purposes and annoyance purposes,
mm-hmm.
but, like, could be a lot harsher... about it, I feel like.
Yeah.
Also, she's in love with Marco, which gets down to maybe my central problem with this book, is that I don't know why the hell the two of them are so deeply in love.
Yeah, Marco makes a comment that all of the tents and attractions he's made at the circus are for her. Because the day that she showed up to audition as their illusionist, he just fell in love with her. But we don't really know why, because we don't get that much interaction between them. There's a scene we get after midnight dinner where he tours her around the house, and that's pretty good, flirtatious, you know, like, beginning of maybe a thing. And then we get nothing for, like, 3 years. And then they kiss at a party. And then, like, in the next chapter, he shows up in her tent, and he's like, let's run away together. And I was like, what?
Yeah, and so they've been enjoying collaborating on the circus, but not directly. Like, he makes something, and then she makes something, and they look at the result, and they're kind of enjoying that interplay, but we just don't get to see enough of them as people or as a couple to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, I think one of the purposes is you show a little bit at the beginning of the romance, and then you have this time skip to where they're talking about running away together, they don't get enough time together, etc., and you're to understand that they've seen and interacted in all those interim years. Mm-hmm. But because you don't get to see any of it, then you can't really connect to it. It was kind of the same thing, the problem I had with Ready Player One, the romance in that.
Yes.
When they had like the cute, flirty interaction, and then he said, okay, we're in love now, or I'm in love with her right now, and I said, why?
What are you doing?
Like, I need more of that to see you falling in love.
Yeah, and it's just a... And I think we've mentioned this on the air before, but the whole thing of, oh, well, my story needs a love story in it, so here's one.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, even, I think it's the story is the love story.
Yeah.
And it just... If you're going to tell a love story, you have to put a little more work into showing it, I think.
Yeah, and I think that is maybe not
as much how it's advertised.
But
it's definitely the thread that's supposed to bind it all together.
Yeah, the summary actually here isn't too bad, but I got online to read some other reviews, and a lot of reviews of the book, or that, you know, just lay people mentioned, or that official reviewers mentioned, it always included a love story, a magical love.
Right.
And by that point in the book, actually, because I was about halfway through and I was looking at a couple of those things, they hadn't even fallen in love yet. Because it takes them a while.
It does, yeah.
And I was like, I don't really know if a love story is the purpose of this book, but then it becomes the purpose of the book.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, and I don't know if you could write it this way, but to make Celia and Marco competitors and so deeply intertwined with each other that, like, one can't be without the other, and they're not necessarily romantically in love, but they're just, like, so connected,
yeah,
that one can't give the other up, but they're not necessarily, like, gonna make babies together or right whatever.
And it sounds like maybe that's a natural side effect of this competition.
Yes.
Because Tsukiko, the contortionist,
the last competition winner,
yes, mentions that the woman that she was in her contest with, that they basically loved each other by the end of it as well.
Uh-huh. So you can't help it, because that other person is your entire world.
Yeah.
Because that's the purpose of your existence, is the competition.
Right.
So that other person just becomes your entire center of being, basically.
And she's one of the couple characters left that I actually want to mention
a little bit.
Yeah, Tsukiko. Because she's just the mysterious woman who shows up. She's the first one to show up, the first act to be hired for the circus. Has some weird tattoos and stuff on her, which turn out to be like the markings in Marco's books. She just prefers not to use pen and paper.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of... she gets briefly interesting towards the very end, and then goes away.
Yeah.
She's doing kind of like the mysterious guiding force, kind of.
Uh-huh.
She goes, okay, well, you're here and you have to help. Well, what's going on? Well, I can't tell you that. Well, what else? You know, here's a bunch of questions. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to answer any of those. Go that way.
Yeah, she says, this has gone for far too long, I'm ending it. And she kind of stands there smoking her cigarette, like, just telling people to go places without really saying why. But we know she's going to end it somehow.
That's right.
And the plan is for her and Marco to basically kill him, but using the bonfire so that the magic's still there to keep the circus going. Because the bonfire is...
Bond him to the bonfire like magicians have been bonded to Merlin, specifically, to a tree.
But Celia's not going to let that happen because she can't live in a world without Marco, so she manages to bond them to the circus instead.
Right. And so now they're ghosts. Kind of. But they're not dead. But they can't interact with things that aren't in the ghost world.
Yeah, like, they were able to kind of talk to Poppet and Bailey, but they're, like, not really visible.
Yeah.
And they're completely visible to each other, but they can't really see other people. It's kind of strange, actually.
Yeah. So Bailey and the twins are the only other characters I think I care enough to talk about at this point in the podcast.
Okay. Well, geez.
Well, I mean, if you want to bring others up, feel free, but I don't know if they're significant. Even though we wrote them down. Bailey gets the most page time after Celia and Marco.
Uh-huh.
And he's a kid trying to decide between the farm and Harvard.
He wants to leave the farm, but his parents count on him to stay there and run it.
Ends up choosing the circus.
Yeah, chooses neither.
That's right.
One of the things I did like about Bailey, well, I liked him and his relationship with Poppet and Widget.
Mm-hmm.
They were all kind of just cute.
Yeah, they were.
Running around. But they make some comment of, well, you weren't chosen to take over the circus, or you're not somehow perfectly suited to...
Right.
You just kind of happen to be the right guy with the right passion showing up at the right time, so you have to take over now, or we're all doomed.
Yeah. He's like, hey, you're not the chosen one, but sometimes being in the right place at the right time is significant.
So. Yeah. So, and he says, yeah, okay.
All right, I'll do it. And then Poppet and Widget are the twins who are...
born the night the circus opens.
And are kind of the circus. Kind of are the circus to some degree.
Because they're a little magical themselves.
Yeah, they were... Alexander made a comment towards the end about people being naturally attuned to it, and the twins being one of the very rare examples having being part of the circus the way they are.
Uh-huh.
So, Poppet, girl twin, Widget, boy twin. Poppet sees the future, Widget
sees the past.
Yeah, sees stories.
Yeah.
Kind of can see your specific past, can read you very deeply, and they both have lots of red hair.
They're Weasleys.
They're Weasleys.
Mrs. Weasley kicked them out because she had too many kids.
That's right. He's like, all right, I've reached my limit. Get out of here.
Damn redheaded children. And they're... I mean... them and Bailey, with their efforts combined, keep the circus going.
Right.
So that's their significance, is that, like, with them, the circus continues and everyone lives on and all that. And they're just kind of cute and fun to follow around. I enjoyed reading their sections.
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded having a little more of them, even.
Yeah. And Ben and I both agree that the Poppet and Bailey chemistry relationship is better than the Celia Marco.
You see more of it happen.
Yeah.
And it is building at a more reasonable pace.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they clearly have a thing for each other, but it doesn't go like, here are two brief points of contact, and then bone zone.
Well, which is good, because they're like 15.
Well, so yeah.
That would have been a little disturbing. I don't think I would have liked that very much.
You wouldn't have gone for that, huh?
No.
Well, I guess I stated my intent to ignore the rest of the characters, but do you want to talk about any of them? I'll be polite.
We can move on.
We don't have to.
That's fine.
All right.
I'll actually talk about one of them later, so...
Okay. Did we decide whether there were moral issues?
Well, we came up with that there's mild slut-shaming.
One scene.
Yeah, after Marco and Celia sleep together for the first time,
two consenting adults.
Her dad calls her a whore.
But I think that's less because of the sex and more because of his precious contest.
Right.
Yeah.
You're getting too close to him.
So we kind of moved past that.
Yeah, I just kind of put it there because we couldn't really think of anything. And then another issue that we kind of thought of was Prospero... Because he comes this kind of weird ghost thing, it's because he was trying to take himself toward immortality and kind of fucked it up.
So he put himself in this weird in-between thing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what Celia and Marco do. They just did a better job of it.
Yeah, yeah. But Alexander A.H. is obviously not... pleased with him trying to do this. He thinks he's an idiot.
Yes,
for it.
As usual in literature, refer to our Tuck Everlasting podcast. people are we are anti immortality for some reason.
It's bad, man.
And you guys, no feminist issues in this book.
No, really, like. We were trying, but...
We were trying as hard as we could.
Equal number of men and women. The women are just as powerful as the men.
Right.
Get about the same amount of screen time. Yeah. They have the same kinds of talents. Like, not really.
Yep.
And no one even ever really says, like, well, you're... There's one mention of, like, well, Celia's a girl, so she can't be an illusionist.
Oh, and yeah, someone says, auditions.
Shut up. And, like, that's the end of it.
True. It's like, well, let's give her a look. And then she blows him out of the water. And there's no more talk of that.
Yep, exactly. So we're going to move on.
Yeah, I almost don't know what to do with myself.
Well, I don't.
I don't even.
I guess moving on to the themes.
All right.
Because we already talked about plot points.
So. All right. So, does love conquer all? Lots of stories seem to think so.
This one, yes.
I guess.
It's
really less a does love conquer all and more of a is love more important than being, like, part of the rest of the world.
Yeah, because what I was saying to Ben was, you know, if you're involved in a competition with, your person you love most, well, romantically, because...
Right.
That's a little different ball of wax. But I'm involved in a competition with the person I love most, and I find out that either he or I has to die, or we can go live in this weird ghost in-between world where we can't really interact with anyone but each other forever. It's like, that actually sounds like a really shitty alternative to me. Like, if I was stuck... And I mean, even with the person that I think is the coolest person in the world, being stuck with them pretty much exclusively is gonna end up sucking.
Yeah, at some point, I'm gonna want to hang out with other people.
Yeah. And I mean, one of you dying is obviously horrible, but I don't... It might be a just as good alternative, honestly.
I'm not
really convinced that's a happy conclusion.
Yeah, I think we more or less came to the conclusion that if Gabs and I were in the contest, we'd have to fight it out.
Yeah. We were like,
you're going down.
I really want to live. Conversation with my fiancé.
Sorry about that.
I don't want you to die, but I'd really want to live. It's like, well, I'd probably sacrifice myself. I was like, cool.
Well, thanks for volunteering. I guess I win. Ka-ching!
You're the best!
Fist pump!
Which is rude of me, but as I mentioned, he doesn't listen, so it doesn't matter. And then the other theme was the idea of, even though there's real magic going on, the magic of the circus is how it captures people's imaginations and hearts.
Right. That's why it has its own fanatic fan club.
Yes, the reverse. The dreamers.
The dreamers.
Who follow the circus around and just love it. it just really speaks to them.
Yeah, they, for whatever reason, it's what they love most in the world, and they follow it around, and they have their little network that figures out where it's going and disseminates it to the rest of the network, so.
Yeah.
And, yeah, well, that's, you know, that's where the whole your imagination thing comes in. Because it seems that a lot of the attractions at the circus are, while they are magical, a lot of them also are supposed to have some personal meaning to you. And actually just want to hit some of those as long as we're at it.
Yeah.
But, you know, for example, the kind of like the non-standard circus stuff, because the circus has a lot of the standard circus entertainment. It's just really high-end versions of it. Like amazing acrobats and a magician who's actually magic and that kind of stuff. But, like, the Pool of Tears is a good example, because you go in there and you pick up a rock and, like, all of the weight of the world, all the sad stuff is coming in your head and you toss it in the pool and you feel unburdened all of a sudden.
Or there's this tent where you can go in and open jars that have certain smells that kind of tell you the story and give you a feeling and kind of take you to a place and you can just try different stuff
out. Yeah, or the wishing tree. You light your candle from someone else's wish. One wish sparks the next one. And you make your wish. And it's all, like, so those things are very personal. Like, would have personal meaning to you. Like, I understand how someone could go through that kind of magic and really feel an attachment to the place. And then some of the other events are more of the magic variety.
It's a ball and awesome variety.
Yeah.
So you have the Winter Garden, which is a tent, a garden, but everything's covered in ice and snow.
It just looks cool.
Yeah, and it's actual ice and snow.
Right.
So you imagine going to the circus in July in Kansas and being like, what?
It's 95, well, okay, it's after dark. It's 88 degrees with 196% humidity. And you walk into the tent and all of a sudden it's ice and snow.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Or the Cloud Maze, which is just a bunch of, like, it's a maze, but on platforms and ladders.
Yeah, you go up and around instead of...
Yeah, and the quickest way out, once you get to where you want to go, is just to jump off the edge.
Yep, and land on some kind of cloud.
Yep. Cloud will catch you, it's cool.
Yeah. There's a carousel, and I don't really understand exactly how it works.
Yeah.
But apparently, instead of just going around in a circle, it, like, takes you on a journey, but we don't really know how.
It's super cool, and it's mostly engineered with some magic supplement.
Yeah.
That seems to be the gist of it. Yeah. We don't really know the details. See, that's a your imagination moment for sure. Aaron Morgenstern's like, oh, cool, a badass carousel. All right, now you figure out why it's this bad.
You figure out why it's cool.
Here you go. Alrighty, so anything else you want to hit in there? Oh, the clock
is
pretty badass.
I don't know if I can even describe the clock.
Yeah, so I guess it's a really cool, ornate clock, and for the first 12 hours of the day, it looks like it's gradually, like, falling apart. And then the next 12 hours of the day, it's gradually reassembling itself into a normal clock.
Yeah,
that's
but
the
then,
gist
like,
of it.
There's tons of stuff on the clock.
Right.
Like, a bunch of different stories and characters doing various things that are emerging and...
I mean, any one aspect of what is happening with this clock sounds impossible, but it is all engineered and built.
It is not even a magic clock!
It's not a magic clock. Because Frederick Thiessen is a one badass motherfucker making clocks.
One thing we didn't mention is that the clock is entirely black and white, and that's another feature of this circus, is that everything's in black and white.
Yes.
So all the performers' costumes are in black and white, the tents are all striped black and white, they put, you know, like, powder on the ground so it's white, all the food is black and white, so and the bonfire at the front is white.
Yeah. Actually, the visual of it sounds kind of neat.
Yeah.
And they're making a movie version of this, apparently?
I think so.
Okay. I can imagine some pretty cool visuals if you got the right people on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, get that really black and white effect, and then every little piece of color would just really leap off the screen.
Yeah, yeah. Like the twins' hair.
Yeah, yeah. A movie I'd potentially be interested in seeing.
Yeah.
If the trailer looks visually spectacular, at least.
Yeah, otherwise there's like...
Otherwise, I don't know if I'd care, yeah.
If it... one other thing we wanted to talk about that doesn't have anything to do with the circus is something that Chandrish, one of the characters we didn't talk about, throws called Midnight Dinners.
Oh, yeah.
And they are dinners that start precisely at midnight, and you get like five, like, delicious freaking courses, food tens. Amazing.
And there's no menu.
Yep. And if you ask what's in it, he gets offended.
Or he just gives you a very mysterious, glib answer.
Just eat it. And, you know, he has a very select group of people who are invited.
Yes.
And the big thing with the midnight dinners is this guy has come up with all sorts of cool ideas and all sorts of connections. And his newest idea is the circus. And he invites a group to help him start planning how it should run.
Yes.
But I also just wanted to mention it because I think a midnight dinner sounds really fun.
It does sound really fun. We've decided we want to have one.
Yeah, we want to host one. We have a novel ideas midnight dinner.
Yes. maybe is a regular thing. No, probably not.
Yeah, probably not.
Unless anyone out there really wants to...
Unless you want to hire chefs.
Make five-course meals for us on the cheap. In which case, we'll talk.
We'd probably be like appetizers, salad, meal, and dessert. It's just all normal food. But it's at midnight.
That's right. We can do a Game of Thrones five-course meal menu starting at midnight. And then...
Everyone who comes has to donate a lot of money.
Yeah, and then vomit copiously between the third and fourth course, and then again after dinner, and then die of eating.
Yay!
Yay! So I guess that takes us to strengths and weaknesses of the writings.
So I think, as we already mentioned, our biggest weakness for the book is that the characters are not developed enough. And I thought the book was pretty easy to read. It didn't take me very long. And I found it pretty compelling, but it didn't really stick with me. The setting of the circus did, but most of the characters just kind of faded.
There's not anything that interesting about them. We didn't really give very deep descriptions of characters when we were talking about them because there aren't very deep descriptions to be had. Like, we don't really know who they are and where they come from and what they want and all of those things. We know that Celia and Marco love each other, and that's about all we know. And that some people love the circus. We know that, too. The writing style is kind of that late 19th century feel to it. Like, if you read stories from that time period, or, you know, pretty much anything written from that general time period, it kind of has that feel.
Yeah, the author's pretty clearly trying to make it sound turn of the century.
Yeah, I think she did a good job of it, mm-hmm. too.
Overall.
Yeah, and there are some... So I think I have, now in my head, when we were outlining, I was having a little trouble, I think, getting this idea across, but I think that some of the writing, some of the stylistic things as far as reading it goes are really well done, and I think some of the things from a more literary bent are slightly affected. Gabs was talking about how you were clearly supposed to take, like, a significant takeaway from certain events at the ends of certain chapters.
Uh-huh. You'd be left with an image of something falling onto the grass.
Right.
And the chapter would end, and you'd go, okay, well, that's obviously supposed to evoke something.
Right, and it felt just a little bit
just a little bit forced at times, maybe. I mean, not in, like, a really obtrusive, obnoxious way.
No.
Not in a way where you're going, ugh, this is so pretentious. But in a way where you're going, you don't have to try that hard. It's okay.
It's
you're
all right.
Telling a decent little imaginative tale here. And so, you know, like, the setting's really interesting. It's pretty much the reason to read the book, in my opinion. Just, I guess, when you come down to it, my take on the strengths and weaknesses of the writing is that when I finished the book, I didn't feel like I was left with all that much.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it while I was reading it, and then I finished, and I was kind of trying to think of some of the things I would want to talk about in the discussion, and I did notice that, like, less meatiness popped up, and more, like, I'm going to discuss, I don't really like the characters that much, or, like, was the chronological order, non-chronological order necessary, or, you know, more like the structure of the book, or, like, aspects of plot or setting as opposed to character issues and
right.
moral issues.
Because those are usually the two things we really get into.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit less of that with this book. So, you know, when you get down to my overall review of it, what I gave it a very sterling review of, I don't think my life would be richer or poorer had I never read it. So, I'm very on this one.
I read Water for Elephants a couple years ago. It's also a book set in the circus, although it's a more traditional circus as opposed to this one, which is more magical. And I thought that this was definitely better than Water for Elephants. There was none of that kind of over-the-top melodrama happening that happened in Water for Elephants, unless you count Marco and Cilla's relationship as over-the-top melodramatic, I guess. So I liked that aspect of it. I liked that circus better, and I liked the main characters better. But I didn't love the book.
Yeah. So what are you reading right now?
In my car, I'm currently listening to The Lady in the Tower by Alison Weir, which is about Anne Boleyn. I just happened to see it at the library and pick it up, even though I don't really need to listen to any more books on tape about Anne Boleyn, but whatever. And then I'm reading a book called Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wien, or Wayne, I'm not really sure how to say her last name, which is about a teenage girl who's a spy for England in World War II. It's pretty interesting.
All right. And because I'm on the cutting edge of recent hot publications, I'm reading Freakonomics. Finally. Finally catching up on that one. By Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dudley, something along those lines. And I think everyone has a pretty good idea of what that is at this point.
Yeah.
So,
that's it, I guess. If you would like to visit us and leave a comment on our website, you can find us at www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Yes, or you can send us an email if you are Rhea, at least, at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter at Novel Ideas Pod.
And, of course, subscribe, rate, comment on iTunes.
So, for next week, we were going to do a book, but then I checked it out from the library a couple days ago, and it is almost 600 pages long, and I don't think we'll be able to finish it.
So, as per our new policy, this is going to be a two-week. However, we're also going to try something new.
Institute another new policy.
That's right. When we have to bump out an extra week for a long book, we're going to try to at least do a short podcast on the off week to throw some content out there.
Yeah, so you guys are still getting something.
And so we're going to do a short story in those off weeks, and we'll see if our episode is 10 minutes or if it's an hour because we can't shut up.
So yeah.
It'll be an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
and so we are going to be reading Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway.
It's a very, very classic, iconic short story. Pretty much everyone has to read it in English class. I say this knowing that everyone's going to be like, I never had to read
because
this
every time
class.
We say that. Also, I never had to read this in English class, but I never took college English classes, really. Except for a Jane Austen class.
But I would I would recommend, if you would like to listen to Hills Like White Elephants, to read it. It's 7 pages, tops. It takes 10 or less minutes to read, but there's a lot to talk about, and if you haven't read it, I think maybe the discussion won't be as good for you.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the idea with this off-week thing. It's something that we can read in a few minutes and still have a little bit of discussion about.
And there's a lot to talk about.
In this case, you guys who are following along, this should be a real easy one for you to hop into because you don't have to go read a 600-page book to know what we're talking about.
No time at all. But then the week after that, we will be doing Doomsday Book by Connie Willis. She is a science fiction writer, and Ben and I were interested in reading her because she became a grandmaster.
Yeah, last year or 2 years ago at the Hugo or Nebula, whichever one of those award ceremonies it is where the science fiction writers hand out all their awards. They made her a Grand Master of Science Fiction, which is basically a Lifetime Achievement Award. And so,
one of the few women.
Yeah, one of the very few women.
And Doomsday Book won both a Hugo and a Nebula Award.
And
so
there you go. So yes, this I'm looking forward to it. I've never read anything by her before, so
it'll be nice to read some science fiction by a woman. See if she has more female characters.
Yeah.
Than all those other guys.
Well, you know, part of the problem, too, is that the other grandmasters were all writing in, like, the 1950s when women didn't exist in society for some reason, even though they were still 50% of the population.
Lies.
Okay, they didn't exist in the future? I don't know. Something fucked up was going on that none of those guys could figure out how to put women into their books. So at any rate,
don't defend them.
That's right. I'm not really defending them. I'm making fun of them.
Yeah.
So
anyway, so for next week, we'll be doing Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway. And then the week after that, Doomsday Book by Connie Willis.
Yep. And so that's going to do it for this time. And we'll see you next week.